it's essentially based on the sort of theory that the jurisdiction can't be trusted. And we don't think that that's appropriate applied to Alaska.
The state weighs in on a lawsuit against the Division of Elections. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Army plans to move a Fort Wainwright Aviation Company to Washington State.
It's going to be more cost-effective if you have a whole unit living, working, and operating in one location versus two locations that are several thousand miles apart.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
The Department of Law has weighed in on a suit in federal court aimed at stopping the Division of Elections from preparing for future elections until all challenges to the new redistricting plan are settled. The division is currently waiting to take the final steps on this year's elections until the U.S. Justice Department approves the state plan under the Federal Voting Rights Act. In a statement released late yesterday, Attorney General Michael Garrity said there is no constitutional reason for the delay because the federal government should not be involved in the issue. Assistant Attorney General Margaret Payton Walsh says the 1965 Voting Rights Act places the pre-clearance requirement on only a few states. Among them is Alaska, which at the time it passed had an English-only language requirement.
It's essentially based on the sort of theory that the jurisdiction can't be trusted. And we don't think that that's appropriate applied to Alaska. And in fact, when the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized in 2006, we don't really believe that the evidence presented there justified the distinction between the states that are covered and the states that aren't covered, because not everybody has to do this.
The language exclusions were later removed, but a ballot initiative in 1998 required all communications with the state government to be in English. That held until 2010, when the state settled a lawsuit in Bethel that claimed its refusal to provide Yupik elections material was a violation of the federal law. Peyton Walsh says the state is committed to providing language assistance for voters and is not trying to undermine the protections of the Voting Rights Act.
We're not saying that we don't think those are important issues or that we don't think that Alaska should be required to not to discriminate or not to provide assistance. So that's not what this is about. This is a much narrower issue that has to do only with this requirement that every time we want to make any kind of a change, we have to go to Washington, D.C.
She says the lawsuit does not consider the time necessary to prepare for an election, and the only obstacle to completion of that work is the absence of federal preclearance. Attorneys with the Native American Rights Fund who filed the lawsuit declined to comment on the state's argument until filing a response in federal court on Monday. The Matanuska River is swollen and threatening riverfront properties. The river is surging with snowmelt brought on by 70-degree temperatures this week. Borough spokeswoman Patty Sullivan says people who are using the river for recreational purposes should stay off of it. The river is expected to crest this weekend. Alaska officials say fishing for king salmon will be banned on the Susitna River drainage beginning next week because of poor runs. Ken Marsh with the State Department of Fish and Game says the ban will take effect at 6 a.m. Monday in an effort to meet minimum spawning goals. The state has posted king salmon restrictions from the Yukon River to southeast Alaska to allow enough fish to make it to spawning areas. Marsh says the new king restrictions in the Susitna River and its tributaries will also bar fishermen from catch and release fishing. The Poor King Run and subsistence closures in the Yukon-Kuskokwim rivers is having state and federal officials monitoring the situation from afar. From KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
Alaska Commissioner of Fish and Game, Cora Campbell, says she's fully informed about what's happening on the Kuskokwim. She says it's possible the King Run is just late, like many residents are saying, but she says numbers still look low.
We did see some really unusual ice conditions this year in the Bering Sea. There are some cold water temperatures, so certainly managers can take all those factors into account, and they do take run timing into account. But at this point, the numbers that they're seeing are low, and they are a cause for concern.
Over the past few years, king salmon runs have been low in many rivers throughout the state. Campbell says that the department's harvest priority is for subsistence after conservation of the resources met through escapement.
Anytime that we have to restrict subsistence, obviously we're very concerned for the people of the region, but particularly, you know, in a situation like this where it is such a large subsistence fishery that so many people rely on. So we're going to be really monitoring this carefully and looking out for the people and keeping an eye on the resource as it develops.
The subsistence harvest for king salmon on the Kuskokwim is 75,000 fish. Campbell was in the governor's office in 2010 when a disaster was declared for the lower Yukon when commercial and subsistence fishers were impacted there.
It was complicated to put together, and there were a lot of players involved, and we had to look at a lot of options, but we did eventually put a package together.
The package brought about $5 million through Congress, which was paid out to fishers on the lower Yukon. The money came from projected losses from the 2008-2009 fishing seasons.
In that particular circumstance, what ended up working was a federal disaster declaration that the governor and some regional leaders requested, and the congressional delegation was also able to help.
Part of that delegation was Senator Lisa Murkowski. She called into a radio show about the Kuskokwim fishery from Washington, D.C.
Even though I'm 1,000 miles away from the region there, please know that I, along with my staff here in Washington and in Alaska, are monitoring the status of both the Yukon and the Kuskokwim and following the fishing reports.
Murkowski says she has to work with the state's administration and the state's Fish and Game Department on how to proceed. Commissioner Campbell says she hopes the Kuskokwim doesn't require a disaster declaration and that the King Run will pick up. She says she also hopes fishers are able to harvest other species. The department has announced three-day openings for salmon fishing with 6-inch gear so subsistence fishers can focus on sockeye and chum salmon. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, contemplating pollution left on Denali.
Within the lifetime of the people managing this mountain, these waste piles are going to start to emerge on the surface. That's what we think.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time home buyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
The Army announced the final phase of a relocation of two aviation units to Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Tacoma, Washington, yesterday. The move includes a company based at Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
In March of 2011, the Department of the Army announced the relocation of two aviation units to Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Tacoma, Washington. The 16th Combat Aviation Brigade at JBLM was originally a split base operation, with units at Fort Hood in Texas and at Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks. Army spokesman Wayne Hall says the relocation of the units back to JBLM makes sense.
It's just easier for the unit to operate as a whole unit and train together, work together, live together, exist together in one location.
Fort Wainwright will lose 129 military personnel. Hall says the decision was based wholly on strategy, but the move will also save the Army some money.
These actions are operationally imperative now to ensure that the Army is properly postured to fully support its strategic commitments. These actions are part of an integrated force structure changes. But, of course, it's going to be more cost-effective if you have a whole unit living, working, and operating in one location versus two locations that are several thousand miles apart.
400 personnel will move from Fort Hood in Texas. The announcement marks the final phase. Hall says most of the people and equipment involved have already been moved. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
About 1,500 climbers attempt to summit Denali each summer, and as they make their way up North America's highest peak, a lot of the human waste they produce gets thrown into the mountain's glacial crevasses. According to a new study, the waste from previous generations of climbers will begin reemerging farther down the glacier a few decades from now, and that reality threatens to transform the pristine quality of the National Park's wilderness area. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Climbers on Denali have generated a lot of human waste over the years, more than 130,000 pounds, in fact, according to Mike Loso's calculations. And the glaciologist from Alaska Pacific University wanted to answer a few questions about that.
Where is that waste going, and when is it going to melt out at the surface again? It wasn't a question that it would. You know, anyone who understands glaciers knows it's going to come back, but when and where?
In 2007, Loso began studying those questions during a research expedition on the West Buttress Route, the most popular way to climb Denali. And the answer he eventually found to that when question is surprisingly soon. Loso says his calculations are conservative, but predicts the waste will begin surfacing on the lower Kahiltna Glacier in 15 to 25 years.
We can't say it precisely, but I think the important piece of that finding is it's not centuries away. It's soon. Given the potential errors in our estimate, it's even possible that it's melting out now, although we don't think so. But it's you know, within the lifetime of the people managing this mountain, these waste piles are going to start to emerge on the surface. That's what we think.
Loso, with graduate student Katie Goodwin, also found that when the waste does emerge, it will still be quite potent. It turns out inner glaciers, which are dark and cool, are very good at preserving the type of harmful bacteria, like E. coli and fecal coliform, that live in human waste. But Loso says because it will be surfacing in such a remote area, the waste doesn't represent a major risk to human health or to the environment.
This human waste is going into a very, very large ecosystem that it's difficult to argue is at all threatened by these quantities. You know, we could do the math and figure out how many kilograms of bear poop are out there, and, you know, we'd come up with a huge number too.
But it is a problem the National Park Service will have to pay attention to in the years ahead, and no one is more aware of that than Roger Robinson, a mountaineering ranger on Denali.
People do travel down that way. So it'd be something that we, Park Service, will have to manage very closely once we start finding this stuff.
Robinson is passionate about keeping the mountain clean, and he says Denali is in vastly better shape today than when he first began his job more than three decades ago. Today, all climbers are required to use clean mountain cans, small bear canister-like toilets that can be strapped to a backpack or sled. A lot of the human waste collected in the cans is flown off the mountain. But he says in the past, most of the waste ended up in crevasses or pit toilets.
We had a lot of pit toilets that were used for the past 35 years or more out of Kiltna Base Camp. And once those start coming out, those will be huge piles of human waste that'll be surfacing.
Climbers are still allowed to throw their waste in crevasses in the middle section of the main climbing route. Robinson would like to see the National Park Service require all waste be carried off the mountain. But he says new regulations are tricky to pass, especially ones that would require climbers to carry more weight and pay more money. But Robinson says it would be worth the extra expense and effort.
There's just no reason to have the prime mountain of, you know, the Americas, Denali, filthy as it once was. And you know, we need to keep it. It is a wilderness mountain, and we need to keep it in that state.
Loso, a climber himself who spent a summer as a junior ranger on Denali, says it's a tough issue. He doesn't think it's necessary for climbers to pack all of their waste off the mountain, but he also doesn't like the idea of spoiling, even in a small way, a remote wilderness area. He says he doesn't buy the argument that we shouldn't worry about a place that sees so few visitors.
Since when does the National Park Service make the argument that the places that are least visited are therefore okay to contaminate or to pollute? It's the opposite. The Park Service, you know, puts on a high pedestal these places that are the most remote and the most wild, and they protect them the most intensely. And here that management practice is sending the contaminants to that very place. And I think that's the hard question.
Roger Robinson thinks the day is coming when climbers will be required to carry out all of their human waste. But even if that does happen, decades of waste will continue marching down the glacier, emerging on the lower Kahiltna as a foul reminder of past expeditions to the top of Denali. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Fire crews are battling a 2,500-acre wildfire near the village of Allicacket. More than 200 firefighters are on the scene today. The fire has been moving northeast away from the village on the south bank of the Keokuk River. Allicacket is 190 miles northwest of Fairbanks. The 39th Mayor's Marathon, held near summer solstice every year, attracts thousands of visitors to Anchorage. This Saturday, the organizers of the road race expect 4,300 runners to tackle the course through Anchorage, including one man with an extraordinary story. APRN's Wendy Jonathan has more.
9 years ago, Don Wright was diagnosed with myeloma, a terminal form of blood cancer. Since his diagnosis, he has decided to run a marathon in every state. This Saturday, Wright will make Alaska his 45th state.
When I was diagnosed, the median survival for this cancer was 5 years. And so right now, not only am I surviving, but I can still run a marathon. And we didn't expect that.
Wright's daughter and also his wife of 50 years run with him to support his efforts. He says they give him the inspiration he needs to keep going. But running also provides some mental therapy for Wright.
Let me tell you how it feels to run the marathon. I like to imagine that I'm floating, you know, just floating across the ground and drifting past the scenery.
1,500 runners are coming into Anchorage from every different state and 16 different countries this weekend. Michael Fries, an organizer of the marathon, says that running is great for anyone's physical health as well as their emotional health.
It's extraordinarily powerful to run this event, to run a marathon, to run a half marathon. In a sense, it's kind of grasping a little bit of control of your life and your own fate.
Don Wright raises money for the nonprofits Team Continuum and Tackle Cancer. After Alaska, Wright and his family will have 5 more states left on their list. They will finish in Hawaii in August, but he doesn't plan to stop running after that. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonathan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Steve Heimel. This week on AK, a cold case. 13 years ago, 8-year-old Durga Owens was found shot to death near his family's remote homestead off the Steese Highway north of Fairbanks. No one has ever been charged with the murder. AK first started looking into the story of Durga's murder 5 years ago. Over the past year, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock discovered that investigators are still reluctant to share any information about the case.
5 years ago, a friend and I hitched up his dog team and journeyed out to Mary Jane Owens' homestead off the Steese Highway for what I thought was a one-time interview.
It's a little bit of an out-of-the-way story. You think you're going to have to ski?
It looks like it's pretty steep uphill, and I don't think these dogs are going to be able to pull all of us.
Owen's son Durga was found shot to death on this hillside near the family's homestead. He is now buried near the chicken coop, which was once a thriving 150-hen farm that provided income for Owens and her children. She believes that her choice to live remote and raise her kids unconventionally affected the investigation from the start.
The first things that the rural troopers did was they tried to bust me for drugs. They wanted to search the house. Before they looked for the little boy, they wanted to search the house. And it was like, I don't care what you search, you know, I mean, just do whatever you have to do so you can get on with it, you know.
Owens believes the troopers stopped looking into any suspects other than the family early on, but charges were never filed against anyone. Initially, an investigator with the cold case unit agreed to let me see some aspects of Durga's file, but it turns out the file wasn't with the cold case unit in Anchorage after all. Last June, it was still with the Alaska State Troopers in Fairbanks.
I was the primary case investigator until basically 2004. It's currently, I guess you could say, in limbo.
That's Lance Dahlke, who is now a lieutenant with Wildlife Enforcement. Dahlke was a criminal investigator with the troopers for 15 years. A year ago, he spoke to me about his reluctance to let the press see Durga's file, even though he was no longer part of the investigation.
It's an old case, so it's an old case file, but it's still open. I can tell you the reason why that it's still open, of course, is because it was never prosecuted.
The initial offer to see the records was rescinded, saying it would hinder the investigation and that the records involved minors. After so many dead ends over the past year, I asked Jim McCann, one of Alaska's most notorious cold case investigators, what he thought. Is the press seen as anything other than just a nemesis in these situations?
No, actually, I use the press to my advantage many times just to keep that case alive and in the public eye. That's actually a pretty good tactic to develop new leads. I mean, it's already worked in this matter, in this case. It's now not just a file sitting locked away someplace. Now it is, as you say, in the hands of the cold case task force.
McCann is responsible for solving many of the most difficult cold case crimes in the state.
I made more major cases than anyone in the state's history.
And he had more convictions than anyone during his 28-year career with the Alaska State Troopers. McCann was the first investigator on the scene when Durga Owens was murdered, but left the troopers a month later. He wouldn't comment specifically on Durga's murder or the details surrounding his resignation from the troopers, but he did have a lot to say about solving cold cases.
Time has a way of loosening people up, too. People that wouldn't talk to you 5, 10, 15 years ago might now talk to you. Murderers themselves have a tendency to open up more, and the old cliche of loose lips sink ships actually plays a big part in solving some of these old cases.
McCann says the operative words are active investigation. That means actually working the case to find new leads.
To have an unsolved case and just let it sit there in a file, I think law enforcement all across the nation has realized that, you know, yeah, that somebody will walk in someday and say something that opens that case up again. But you can actually actively work those cases and develop new information, new evidence, and prosecute those cases.
Lieutenant Craig Allen with the Alaska Bureau of Investigation spoke with me last summer, but did not respond to repeated messages left over the past 2 months. He did say that Durga's file is with the cold case unit now, but with 99 cold cases on the books as of last June and only 4 investigators, they have to prioritize.
If we get a new lead that's brought to our attention on a particular case, we'll reinitiate our efforts to apply investigative technique to that lead to see if it'll help us resolve that case.
I mean, I would be delighted if somebody would talk.
Mary Jane Owen says 13 years is a very long time for a mother to wait for answers.
I have never found out what happened to my son.
For AK, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
This story was made possible by a grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism. Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're going to Vinatai, an interior community above the Arctic Circle.
My name is Eddie Frank. My name of my village is Vinatai, and I'm the tribal administrator. Okay, if you know where Fairbanks is, okay, you look, go directly north. About 150 miles, there's the Chandelier River. It's called the Chandelier River. We're about 150 miles due north of Fairbanks, right on the Chandelier River. Well, the last census, I think, said about 80-something, but there was a lot of our members coming back in the summer. So I'm guessing closer to 200. There's a younger group here. There, we had only one high school student this year, but all of them were middle school and lower grade. People enjoy coming here for, you know, our activities like Spring Carnival. Some people come during the 4th of July. Some people come during Christmas and New Year's because we have potlatches and dances, you know, fiddle dances. And these activities happen without alcohol. The day after the 4th of July, we have what we call a John Fritzson Day. John Fritzson is the founder of Civitai, and Arctic used to be a reservation before Engska. One of the biggest reasons I think I like living there is that I can live off the land if I needed to. I think our language is slowly going away, but because I remember when I first came here, I moved here in 1980, and there was one group of young people that were here that spoke our language fluently, and now those kids are in their mid-30s now, and the rest of them are coming behind them, you know, because of the influence of TV and school and all that. They're not using the language as much.
Eddie Frank is the tribal administrator for Vinatai. 300 villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK This Week. We had help from Bonnie Sue Hitchcock, Wendy Johnson, Dave Waldron, and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Steve Heimel.
And finally tonight, we have a correction. Earlier this week, we aired a story about a bill in Congress that would cede tens of thousands of acres of the Tongass National Forest to the Sealaska Corporation. A source in the story says Sealaska will have free rein on future sites for a variety of uses. This is incorrect. The bills in Congress contain covenants prohibiting any commercial timber harvest or mineral development on future sites, as well as cemetery and historic sites. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Fairbanks and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, and Annie Fite and Wendy Johnson from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.